At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Epochs!
Hello and welcome back to Epochs. If you remember last time, we left off with the Voyage of Magellan just as it had left mainland Spain. So let's just continue the story straight from there. We'll be using the account of Antonio Pigafetta, who was actually there, as well as the analysis of Lawrence Burgreen in his great book, Over the Edge of the World. Okay, we're told this, quote, on the 10th of August, Antonio Pigafetta recorded in his diary, quote, the fleet, having been furnished with all that was necessary for it, and having in the five ships people of diverse nations to the number of 237 in all, was ready to depart from Seville, and firing all the artillery, we set sail with the staysail only. Pigafetta's headcount probably omitted 20 crew members who were also on board, so it is closer to 260-odd. Guys, maybe one or two more even. We're told only Magellan remained behind, making last-minute provisions, and he would join the fleet shortly before its final departure from Spain. So they sailed out of Seville down the river, the Guadalquivir River, right to the very edge, right to the Atlantic coast, where there's a place called San Luca de Barrameda, and that really is their final pushing-off point. Burgreen tells us, quote, beyond the huddled town of San Luca de Barrameda lay the churning waters of the Atlantic. To Magellan and his crew, the body of water was known simply as the Ocean Sea, believed to girdle the entire globe. At the sight of these seething green waters, every sailor's pulse quickened. Their lives depended on conquering this element. Many ships had departed from San Luca de Barrameda, and some had been fortunate enough to return from distant ports and newly discovered lands, but none had circumnavigated the entire world. Magellan took command of his fleet just before departure, and made sure that his sailors led a pious existence during what might be their last days on land, Pigafetta tells us. A few days later, the Captain General went along the said river in his boat and the masters of other ships with him, and we remained for some days at the port to hear mass on land at a church named Our Lady of Barrameda, where the Captain General ordered all those of the fleet to confess themselves before going further, in which he showed the way to others. Moreover, he would not allow any woman, whoever she might be, to come onto the fleet and to the ships for many good reasons, end quote. So there's a thing about women stowaways on ships, very, very common, actually, even these relatively small 16th century ships, all the way up through the 17th, 18th, 19th century. You wouldn't think they could be stowed away in secret, but often they were. The poor plight of these women, obviously being used for physical purposes. Quite often, I'm thinking in sort of the 19th century, the captains or the senior officers knew that there was a woman or more than one stowed away somewhere deep in the belly of the ship. And they sort of turned a blind eye to it because it kept the men a bit calmer than they might otherwise have been. Quite often a captain would absolutely insist that there were no women aboard. And anyway, Magellan goes for that option. Burgreen continues saying, quote, Magellan's autocratic style extended beyond religious observance. To stifle dissent, Pigafetta writes, Magellan concealed the ultimate goal of the expedition from his rank-and-file sailors. What a thing to do. Don't even tell them he's going to attempt to circumnavigate the globe, or at least round the bottom of South America. They just know they're going to, at some point, head across the Atlantic and sail down the west coast of Africa and head across the Atlantic. That's all they really know. Pigafetta tells us this, quote, he, Magellan, did not wholly declare the voyage that he wished to make, lest the people from astonishment and fear refuse to accompany him on so long a voyage as he had in mind to undertake, in view of the great and violent storms of the ocean sea whither he would go, end quote. Bergring tells us that that really needs to be clarified, because it wasn't a complete secret, because the Armada was known at the time, before they left, as the Armada de Molucca. So the idea that they were going to go to the Spice Islands, or in some way, at the very least, at the very, very least, that the fleet was in some way going to be associated with the Spice Islands. So it couldn't necessarily have been a complete secret. Nonetheless, this thing has always attached itself to Magellan's voyage, that a lot of the men embarked upon it under false or fake assumptions. Well, Bergreen says, yet everyone realised that the fleet was bound for the Spice Islands. It was even called the Armada de Molucca. Perhaps Pigafetta meant that Magellan wished to keep his plans to find a strait, a waterway leading to the east, to himself, until it was too late for disloyal crew members to desert. Inevitably, the plan meant trouble, because once the fleet encountered storms, then uncharted waters, and finally a search for an unknown strait, the men whom he had hoodwinked into coming along were likely to rise up in rebellion against him. In the pages of his diary, Pigafetta confided another of the far more troubling reasons for Magellan's unusual secrecy. And these are Pigafetta's words. The masters and captains of the other ships of his company loved him not. I do not know the reason, unless it be that he, the captain general, was Portuguese, and they Spaniards and Castilians, which peoples have long borne ill will and malevolence towards each other, end quote. So remember here, Pigafetta he's actually an Italian. He's a Venetian, I believe. He's certainly not Spanish or Portuguese. And he is, once again, if you remember from last time, he is a Magellan loyalist. So this voyage will, again, kind of inevitably split up into different parties, those that remain loyal to Magellan under almost any circumstances and those that don't. So just bear in mind that Pigafetta is one of those that does remain loyal. Okay, then we're told a lot about, I won't go into too much detail about this because it isn't that interesting, but all sorts of different signals and regulations that Magellan put in place to try and make sure they don't sail apart from each other during the night, and various things like that. And the system of watches involved, various regulations. And Magellan is a bit of a taskmaster, as we've said. He's got quite strict, very strict rules, as is only really right on ship, but you can go too far with it, right? But he's a stickler for the rules, and it's his rules, no one else's rules, only his. Okay, by the 20th of September, 1519, they do strike out into the Atlantic. Well, and first they go down the West African coast. One of the big things to mention here is that King Manuel of Portugal, not satisfied with his attempts to just try and convince Magellan not to go, just to try and undermine the entire project politically and interpersonally, he has now apparently sent out ships, Portuguese ships, to try and hunt down and even intercept Magellan's fleet. So on top of everything else, Magellan is sort of, you know, in a sense, he's on the run from any Portuguese ships. And the Atlantic, largely at this time, is supposed to be kind of a Portuguese sphere of interest. So, as I say, on top of everything else, he's got to try and evade any sort of Portuguese counter fleet. Pigafetta says, when the hour had arrived in which they had to make sail, the pilot ordered the men to raise all but one of the anchors and to attach the cable on the last anchor to the capstan. And with the yards and sails aloft, he ordered two apprentices to climb the foremast and stand ready to unfurl the sails when and as they were ordered and directed. Okay. Bergreen says, quote, amid the intricately choreographed flurry of activity aboard the ships, officers shouted orders, but their words at this crucial moment sounded more like prayers than commands. And Pigafetta says, and if the special pilot for the sandbar said that it was time to make sail, the ship's pilot would call out the following to the two men aloft on the yard. Ease the rope of the foresail in the name of the Holy Trinity, Father and Son and Holy Spirit, three persons in one single true God, that they may be with us and give us good and safe voyage and carry us and return us safely to our homes. End quote. With these words ringing in their ears, the sailors hauled the hemp ropes holding anchors, set the sails, and felt the breeze freshen against their faces. The ships picked up speed and the coastline began to recede. There was no turning back now. It would sustain them or it would destroy them all. To reach his goal, Magellan would have to master both the great ocean sea and a sea of ignorance. Because as I said before, they still had all sorts of strange ideas and notions about about the ocean and about far-flung lands that hadn't been visited or certainly hadn't been explored properly. And, well, let's talk a little bit more about some of those ideas. Bergreen says, it was a dream as old as the imagination, a voyage to the ends of the earth. Yet until the age of discovery, it remained only a dream. At the time, Europe was deeply ignorant of the world at large. Magellan undertook his ambitious voyage in a world ruled by superstition, populated with strange and demonic creatures, and reverberating with a longing for religious redemption. To the average person, the world beyond Europe resembled the fantastic realms depicted in The Thousand and One Nights, a collection of tales, including the seven voyages of Sinbad the Sailor. Going to sea was the most adventurous thing one could do, the Renaissance equivalent of becoming an astronaut, but the likelihood of death and disaster was far greater. These days, there are no undiscovered places on Earth. In the age of the global positioning system, no one need get lost. But in the age of discovery, more than half the world was unexplored, unmapped, and misunderstood by Europeans. Mariners feared they could literally sail over the edge of the world. They believed that sea monsters lurked in the briny depths, waiting to devour them. And when they crossed the equator, the ocean would boil and scald them to death. Some of the most tenacious ideas about the world at large derived from Pliny the Elder, who died in the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in 79 AD. His multi-volume encyclopedia, Natural History, rediscovered and widely consulted in the Renaissance, sought to bring together everything that was known about the natural world, mountains, continents, flora and fauna. Pliny's chapters on humankind contained a potent mixture of fact and fantasy. He wrote of a tribe known as the Arimaspi, and this is Pliny now, a people known for having one eye in the middle of their forehead. He currently cited other classical authorities, such as Herodotus, who related tales of, quote, a continual battle between the Arimaspi and griffins in the vicinity of the latter's mines. The griffins had gold mines. The griffin is a type of wild beast with wings, as is commonly reported, which digs gold out of tunnels. The griffins guard the gold and the Arimaspi try to seize it, each with remarkable greed. Pliny meant this vivid description literally, and while it might have generated some scepticism among naturalists of Magellan's time, it was generally accepted as fact, as was Pliny's curious description of forest dwellers who have their feet turned back behind their legs. They run with extraordinary speed and wander far and wide with the wild animals. India offered particularly fertile ground for extraordinary creatures. Pliny evoked men with dogs' heads who are covered with wild beast skins. They bark instead of speaking and live by hunting and fowling, for which they use their nails. At one time, says Pliny, over 120,000 of these hominids flourished throughout India. Pliny assured his readers that wonders never ceased in the natural world. The result of his labours was a Ripley's Believe It or Not catalogue tinged with the classics. That women have changed into men is not a myth, he wrote. We find in historical records that a girl at Casinium became a boy before her parents' very eyes. To emphasise this point, Pliny claimed to have first-hand knowledge of the phenomenon. Pliny again. In Africa, I myself saw someone who became a man on his wedding day. End quote. There are more. He claimed that people in Eastern Europe had two sets of eyes, backward-facing heads or no heads at all. In Africa, Pliny wrote, lived people who combined both sexes in one body yet managed to reproduce. People who survived without eating, people with ears large enough to blanket their entire bodies, and people with equine feet. In India, he said, there were people with six hands. These marvellous accounts were subsequently retold by various respected chroniclers and widely credited up through Magellan's time. In the open waters of the ocean lurked even more bizarre creatures, whales and sharks, 6-foot-long lobsters and 300-foot-long eels. Sailors had no way of telling which of Pliny's descriptions were reliable and which were fantasies. They were just as ignorant about major land masses. Only three continents were known to Europeans at the era, Europe, Asia and Africa, although it was suspected that more would be discovered. The existence of an illusory island, Terra Australis, the Southland, was accepted as fact, and long before Magellan's voyage, this landmass was said to lurk in the southern hemisphere, where its vast size supposedly counterbalanced the continents in the northern hemisphere. Highly schematic medieval maps depicted the three known continents as separated by two rivers, the Nile and the Don, as well as the Mediterranean, all of them surrounded by the Great Ocean Sea, into which other seas and rivers flowed. This diagram resembles a T inside of an O, so medieval maps of this genre are referred to as T in O maps. To remain consistent with religious traditions, T in O maps located Jerusalem at dead centre, with paradise floating vaguely at the top. To complicate matters, Asia occupied the northern hemisphere of this map, with Europe and Africa sharing the southern. In some versions of the medieval map, the ocean sea flowed out into space. One could not navigate with such maps or locate points on the compass on it, or plot realistic routes. They offered a conceptual model rather than an actual representation. As such, they were utterly useless to Magellan, end quote. So yeah, there are lots and lots of maps. I'm fascinated, as are most history nerds, by the history of maps and cartography, what the ancient people or medieval or pre-modern people, how they did their maps. The Mappa Mundi is a very famous one from the British Isles, and absolutely fascinated by them. But as Bergreen says there, they're not a modern map in the sense that you can actually use it, certainly not in any accurate way, to actually navigate and travel. I mean, in the vaguest sense, you can. You know, like the cities along a coastline will be in order, right? And the coastline, especially well-known coastlines, will be relatively kind of accurate. But as for knowing exactly where you are on the globe, you know, it's no good. They won't work. And that is exactly what people like Magellan and all navigators need. Okay, a few more details about a few more fantastical things they thought they might come into contact with. There's this idea of Prester John. Prester is sort of an archaic way of saying presbyter or priest. They thought that there was this person called, completely fictional, called Prester John, who lived way out in the Far East, in like China, Central Asia or China. And he was a Christian king, a great and powerful Christian king that one day might help them in their fight against the Muslims. And it was just a sort of comforting thought that there might be this super powerful king, like Kublai Khan or a Genghis Khan style powerful Christian king in the Far East, in the Orient. And if you could ever hook up with him or get to his court, it would be, it would be a safe port and all that sort of thing. Of course, it was just wrong. It's just a misconception. There's also the idea of the Fountain of Youth. This was a big thing that a lot of people believed at that time, that somewhere there was this Fountain of Youth, and if you drunk the waters, then you would become young again. So Bergreen tells us, in 1513, only 6 years before Magellan undertook his circumnavigation, Juan Ponce de Leon set out to find the Fountain of Youth. Peter the Martyr, another trusted authority of the Renaissance, described the Fountain of Youth as a spring of running water of such marvellous virtue that the water thereof, being drunk, perhaps with some diet, makes old men young again. According to tradition, the Fountain of Youth was located on the island of Bimini in the Bahamas. On the strength of his reputation as a soldier, nobleman, and participant in Columbus's second voyage to the New World, Ponce de Leon received a commission from King Ferdinand to claim Bimini for Spain. In a fruitless search, Ponce de Leon explored the Bahamas and Puerto Rico, but his failure to find the Fountain of Youth did not put the myth to rest. As late as 1601, the respected Spanish historian Antonio de Herrera Silias wrote confidently about the fountain's great efficacy in restoring youth and potency to young men. Although his quest seems fanciful and absurd today, Ponce de Leon was a man of his times. Superstition governed popular impressions and even scholarly accounts of the world at large. A work published in 1560 contained descriptions of various sea monsters infesting the oceans. One, known as the Whirlpool, was said to have a human countenance. Another, supposedly sighted in 1531, had hideous scaly skin. There were others, the satyr of the sea, the rosmarus, which rivaled an elephant in size, and the wondrous scolopendra and its face of flames. Voyagers across the sea, especially those attempting to circumnavigate the globe, could expect to encounter all these creatures and more in the course of their journey. End quote. So something to say is that even though they are still superstitious, and I don't necessarily mean that word as an outright pejorative, being ignorant, you know, there's nothing necessarily wrong with being ignorant, right? I'm ignorant of knitting. I don't know how to knit, right? There's nothing wrong with not knowing something necessarily. And it's not your fault often if there's no way of knowing something. But still, they were, it is the right word, they were ignorant of the world at large in all sorts of senses, in all sorts of ways. But still, certainly the officers or the learned, the people that could read, would have read as much as they possibly could about these things. And a lot of them had already done a lot of travelling. You know, Magellan had been out to the Indian Ocean. He'd been to India for years and years on end, remember? He'd spent 8 or 9 years out in India. So it's not like he was green. It was not like he never left Europe before, anything like that. And people that could read would read anything or everything they could of others that had done fantastic travels. Two of the biggest ones at the time were the accounts of Marco Polo, or his book was called The Travels of Marco Polo. And he's long before this period. I mean, that dates from the late 13th century, very, very early 14th century. So, you know, a while ago now. And Marco Polo, whether he was a habitual liar or whether he did do all the things and see all the things that he said he did, one way or another, he certainly had travelled far and wide. Many people do question some of the things, or a lot of the things Marco Polo said. Still, it was one of the very, very few accounts that someone like Columbus or Magellan or De Gama would certainly have read. And there was also The Travels of Sir John Mandeville. And I'll let Bergreen tell us a little bit about Mandeville. He says, quote, "Sir John Mandeville served as the other great traveller and storyteller of the era. With suave assurance, he deftly mixed accounts from ancient authors with what he claimed were his personal experiences. But Mandeville was actually a compiler rather than a traveller, and he drew much of his material directly from Speculum Mundi, a medieval encyclopedia, which contained extracts from Pliny and Marco Polo, among other authorities. As a finishing touch, he wove long passages from the Pester John letters into his account and passed it off as his own work. Mandeville told jaw-dropping stories of his pilgrimages to the Holy Land, an unlikely event. He probably never got any further than a noble's well-stocked library. He claimed he traversed India, which he said was filled with yellow and green people, visited Prester John's kingdom without giving comprehensible directions, and even made it all the way to the borders of paradise, but failed to enter because he considered himself untrustworthy. He naturally claimed to have found the Fountain of Youth in the course of his travels and imbibed three draughts of its life-giving waters." And these are his words, he's supposed to have said, "And evermore since that time, I feel me the better and the wholer." End quote. So again, if your job is to actually travel the world, and to actually circumnavigate the globe, you're not probably, well, you won't be served all that well by the stories of Mandeville or Polo. I mean, some of them might help. There's certainly elements in Marco Polo which are true. But if you just want pure fact, pure reality, they're probably going to steer you further wrong than right. Okay, enough of that. Let's carry on with the actual voyage of Magellan, because things are rocky politically within the ships straight away. But Magellan is blessed with some good weather to begin with, which stops the men and the rival captains from sort of, you know, truly immediately bringing things to a head. Bergreen tells us, "Fair weather favoured the Armada de Mallorca, and gusts carried the black ships southwest to the Canary Islands off the coast of Western Sahara." Pigafetta says, "We left Sanlúcar on Tuesday, September 20th, on the said year, laying a course by the southwest wind. And on the 26th of the said month, we arrived at an island of the Grand Canary named Tenerife, where we remained for 3.5 days to take in provisions and other things which we needed." End quote. So even though, you know, the Canaries aren't very far from Spain, that really is the last time, that will be the last possible moment when you can take on, you know, fresh water, extra food, anything at all, because from this point on, it's just open ocean. So, right, so leaving Seville isn't the last, even leaving Sanlúcar isn't the last, but when you push off from Tenerife, that's going to be it. Or the Cape Verde Islands. Bergreen, quote, "For centuries, this group of 7 volcanic islands, Gran Canary, Fuerteventura, Lanzarote, Tenerife, La Palma, Gomera, and Herrero, had served as a stopover for ships bound to and from the Iberian Peninsula. They were known to Pliny, and classical historians may have been referring to the Canaries when they wrote of the Fortunate Islands. Later, a succession of Arab and European voyagers, carried by strong, favourable winds, frequently called on the Canaries to replenish their supplies, convert the islanders, or capture slaves. The islands began to appear on maps in 1341. At the time of Magellan's arrival in late September 1519, the Canaries glistened in the waters of the Atlantic. While there, Pigafetta confirmed an ancient story about the Canaries." This is Pigafetta. "Know that among the other islands that belong to the said Grand Canary, there is one where no drop of water coming from spring or river is found, save that once a day, at the hour of noon, there descends from heaven a cloud which encompasses a great tree in the said island. Then all its leaves fall from it, and from the leaves is distilled a great abundance of water, that it seems a living fountain. And from this water, the inhabitants of the said place are satisfied, and the animals both domestic and wild." End quote. Bergreen goes on. This observation marked the first time that Pigafetta tested his first-hand experience against the claims of ancient writers, in this case Pliny, who had written of a magical fountain in the Canaries with no source. It seemed to Pigafetta that there was a natural source of water, a rain cloud. Though hardly a revolutionary insight, the comment set Pigafetta apart from sages such as Pliny and Marco Polo, who relied on hearsay or the artful blending of hearsay and fact. If Pigafetta had any idea of emulating Polo, he gave up that notion now. Instead of embellishing time-worn legends about the world, he would represent phenomena as he observed them with his own eyes, and he would test the legends against what he actually saw and experienced. With this entirely factual approach, Pigafetta broke with a tradition that reached back to antiquity, end quote. So that's great. That's one of the reasons why Magellan's voyage, why Pigafetta's account of Magellan's voyage, let's say, is so good, because it looks like, or it seems like, even under, you know, close scrutiny, Pigafetta is very rarely, if ever, lying. Sometimes, or often, he will omit something. If it's something embarrassing to Magellan, he will just omit it entirely. Okay, there's that. And it seems like sometimes he might have ever so slightly exaggerated something here or there. But as for just making up things whole cloth, making up fanciful things like a fountain of youth or something, or he'd visited Prester John's court, or he'd found his way to the gates of paradise or something. There's nothing like that. There's nothing like that. And things he does tell us, you know, we can confirm are true, you know, in later centuries when Southeast Asia was fully explored. Pigafetta's accounts are essentially reliable, almost entirely reliable, which is nice, right, for us, for the historian. It's nice to know that we don't have to sort of question every tiny thing, like Herodotus. And I don't blame Herodotus. He did say right at the beginning of his book, I'm only telling you what I've heard. I'm only a compiler. Don't ask me if it's true or not. I'm just telling you what I've heard. So Pigafetta's not doing that. So that's good, isn't it? So Magellan gets his final provisions in the Canaries, and they were bad ones. He got duped, he got fooled, which is really bad, because, you know, every ounce of food or water is really important. And if the numbers are out, the figures are out, then you could be in trouble real quick. So Bergering tells us this, quote, during those brief days in the Canaries, Magellan busied himself with the final provisioning of his fleet. He worked quickly, too quickly, as he would later discover to his horror, for the merchants and chandlers of the Canaries practiced in deception, swindled Magellan by falsifying their bills. They vastly overestimated the amount of supplies they sold to the fleet, and what they did sell was in poor condition. This type of cheating was common and very dangerous to the expeditions whose lives depended on the food acquired in the Canaries. Although Magellan was normally meticulous in preparing his ships, this time he was too trusting of his suppliers. After three busy days in one of Tenerife's harbours, Pigafetta wrote, quote, we departed thence and came to a port called Monterose, where we remained 2 days to furnish ourselves with pitch, which is a thing very necessary for ships. Bergering goes on. While there, Magellan heard disturbing news. The King of Portugal had dispatched not one, but two fleets of caravels to arrest him, a drastic measure, but not without precedent. A generation earlier, Manuel's father had sent ships to intercept Columbus. Magellan also received a secret communique from his father-in-law, Diogo Barbosa, warning that the Castilian captains of the Armada de Maluca planned to mutiny at the very first chance. They might even kill Magellan to attain their goal. Keep a good watch, Barbosa admonished. The ringleader's name came as no surprise to Magellan, Juan de Cartagena, the Castilian with blood ties to Bishop Fonseca, his illegitimate son. In his reply to Barbosa, Magellan insisted he had accepted command of the fleet, come what may, but he promised that he would work closely with his captains for the good of the fleet and of Spain. Barbosa showed these conciliatory words to the Casa de Contracción, and Magellan won praise for gracious sentiments, at least in the short term. Despite this display of diplomacy, Magellan's concern about the safety of his fleet and his own life could only have increased as he contemplated the Portuguese ships in hot pursuit. Unwilling to give his rebellious captains further cause for alarm, he kept both warnings to himself. If you enjoyed that preview, please consider heading over to lotuseaters.com to watch the full unabridged video.
At At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
Terms and conditions apply.
This holiday season, reach for the one butter that never disappoints, Kerrygold. Made with milk from grass-fed cows on Irish family farms, it's rich, creamy, and perfect for baking. Whether browning butter for cookies or crafting the flakiest pie crust, Kerrygold's high butterfat content makes all the difference in flavor and texture. Holiday treats will taste extraordinary.